Well, hello. This is Andrew Barber Starkey, welcoming you to the Mastermind Interview Series, where every month we give you direct access to the wisdom of the most important authors, speakers, and trainers of our time. You know, I've been heavily involved in personal growth since the late 1980s, and I still remember the time I came up with my own personal answer to that nagging, lifelong question, what is the purpose of life? It may be different for you, but let me share my purpose with you in the hope that you find it useful. My life purpose is to create for myself the richest, fullest, and most deeply soul-satisfying life experience possible. Now, when I discovered that, it was nice to know, but it also created a new problem. If the purpose of my life is to create the richest, fullest, and most deeply soul-satisfying experience possible, how the heck do I go about doing that? I've been working on that for years, but a few months ago I found a book that gave me many of the answers that were very, very helpful in that direction. If you want to create an amazing life for yourself, you've definitely come to the right place. My guest today is a man who spent his whole life in search of what causes some people to lead lives of deep satisfaction and few regrets, while others endure their time on this planet rather than enjoying it, and they end their lives with sad resignation at what their life might have been. Dr. John Izzo is one of North America's most sought-after business and personal growth thought leaders, and he holds advanced degrees in religion and psychology. He's worked with more than 700 companies around the world and has spoken to over a million people on four continents. His pioneering work has been featured on CBC, CNN, ABC, pretty well anything with three letters in it, I think, the Globe and Mail, the LA Times, Washington Post, and hundreds of other publications and media outlets. Today I'm talking to him about his fifth book, a compelling read and a bestseller, entitled The Five Secrets You Must Discover Before You Die. This is based on a five-part television series that aired on the Biography Channel in Canada and later on PBS in the United States. It is a book that contains the holy grail that I've been searching for. What do we need to do to create the richest, fullest, and most deeply soul-satisfying life experience we can possibly have? John, it's just a privilege to have you on the phone today. I'm so glad we're having this conversation.
Thank you, Andrew, and great to be here, and hello to your listeners.
Okay, so you wrote a book called The Five Secrets You Must Discover Before You Die. Now, that's, as I mentioned in the introduction, kind of a part of a lifelong quest. So why don't you just tell me how this book came about before we even get into it?
Well, you know, Andrew, one of my earliest memories as a child is my mother used to say to me when I was very young, "You think too much." And I'm talking about when I was like a really young child. I remember her saying, "You think too much." And I realized that from when I was very young, I was a seeker. I wanted to know the meaning of things. Why am I here? Why are we here? What's the purpose of life? And it led me to seek really a life in the realm of the spirit, if you will. And my first career, I went to a seminary, to graduate school after my undergraduate, and became an ordained Presbyterian minister. 8 years later, left the parish ministry, and I say left the parish ministry because in some ways I think I still am a preacher in many ways, although my spirituality has become much broader over the decades. And then I've really spent my life writing books and speaking all over the world and meeting people and seeking to answer that one question that has always motivated me. What is the meaning of life, and why do some people achieve extraordinary levels of wisdom and happiness while we're here? And so that's been my life's journey. And in the process of trying to answer that question, I suppose I've answered it for myself and gotten the privilege of meeting thousands of people and learned from them. And I think the last thing I'd say is I think this is the great task of life is life is so short, to learn from other people's experience, not just your own. And that's always been my goal, I guess.
Okay, so you came up with a rather interesting concept. I mean, you know, often when we're looking, let's say, a health professionals are looking at how to make people have more healthy lives, we look at the people that are sick and you know, try to figure, okay, well, how do we not do what they're doing, or how do we fix the problems they've got? And obviously, we'd be so much better served at looking at people that are healthy, and figuring out what they're doing and trying to do more of it. But you took that kind of approach with this book as well. So can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think really if you want to know the secrets to happiness or to having a meaningful life, find someone who's lived it and ask them. And so that's what I did about 2 years ago. When the Biography Channel asked me to do a TV series for them, I started asking people all over the United States and Canada to tell me the one person they knew who had lived a long life, found true happiness, and had something to teach us. And I really had no idea what kind of response I would get, but to make really a long journey short, over a two-year period, I got almost 1,500 suggestions from all over both countries. And in the end, interviewed 250 people from the age of 60 to 106, from a town barber in Waukon, Iowa, to native chiefs, from Holocaust survivors to entrepreneurs and CEOs. 250 people with 18,000 years of life experience who had one unique characteristic that they shared, which was that every one of them was the one person someone said was the one person they knew who had lived long and found true happiness. And so for almost a year, I interviewed every week people who had found true happiness and tried to discover what was the alchemy, what was the chemistry that they shared in common. And that was really the journey I went on. And I think it bore some very interesting things.
Well, it certainly did. So what you discovered is that there actually were some commonalities amongst them. I just wanted to ask you a question before we get into it. You asked for people that were essentially over 60. Why that barrier? I mean, does that mean that those of us that aren't 60 yet don't know, or, you know, we're still naive, or what's the reason?
You know, this is you know, an interesting question, because actually we didn't ask for over 60 in the first round. We just said, who do you know who's lived a long life and found true happiness? And by the way, for those of us who are over 50, I just turned 50 last year, is that I can tell you 50 is when people say you've lived a long life, because we didn't get any recommendations for anybody under 50. But an interesting thing happened. There were three of us who did these interviews. I did about half of them, and a couple of other people, two people did the other half, and then I listened to each one of the interviews on a tape recording. But the interesting thing is that after we did about the first 30 interviews, we all got together and said, how's it going? And we all discovered that it's somewhere around 60 that people become reflective about their lives. And, you know, I think it makes sense if you really think about it, that somewhere around 60, we start to really take stock and think about what we've learned. And in an ironic way, I think is very spiritual way, that I think we, in a way, prepare to die. And not in, I mean that in a morbid sense, but we prepare to pass on our wisdom. And so somewhere around 60, we seem to step into our wisdom. So we then made the cutoff at 60. And so that's why we wound up doing mostly people over 60. We didn't start out that way, but it seemed like that's the magic age. So our ancient kind of belief that older people and our grandparents knew something we didn't, I think turns out to be true.
Uh-huh. So, even before you got into talking about what the five commonalities were, the five secrets that came out that all of these people had, you mentioned that a lot of us, you know, when we're asked what we want in life, we talk about we're looking for happiness. And yet there's something more that we're seeking as well. Could we just talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've met so many people over the years, you know, because of speaking all over the world and advising companies, I've had one of the greatest privileges, even when I was a minister, is I've gotten to share in the stories of other people's lives. And just as an aside, one reason people ought to read this book and or take the journey of seeking the wisdom of others is because it seems to me that you know, you can learn from your own experience, but the most successful people and the happiest people also learn from the experience of others. And if you think about it, if you're only going to live maybe 75 years with the average lifespan, you're going to get a lot more benefit from learning also from the experience of others. But, you know, one of the things that I've learned is that I think we talk that people want happiness, but I think actually the two things that human beings really want most are, first of all, we want to know we didn't miss the party. we want to know that, that whatever vitality and life there was to live, that, that, you know, that somehow we found it. And second, we want to know that, that our life meant something. I think we figure out very young in our lives that we're mortal, that we're not here forever, at least in this way. And so we want to know, did it matter that I was here? Was anything different because I was here? And those are the two things I think we seek. And, you know, there's a great Mary Oliver poem, one of the greatest poets of our age. And she said, you know, she has a great poem called When Death Comes. And I love her last line. She said, when it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made anything of my life. I don't want to end my life full of sighing, frightened, and arguing. I don't want to end up simply having visited the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a way, is what I think we want. We want to know that we come to the end of our lives and we don't say, boy, I wish I could do it over because I just visited the world. I didn't really engage with it.
You know, sometimes I feel a little cynical, I must say, about all, you know, all of the marketing and the, you know, get-rich-quick things and the, you know, the emphasis on, you know, instant gratification and happiness and so on. And I'm wondering what your comment on that. Are we being misled by the media and by our society to maybe lead a surface life and therefore possibly actually miss the party?
I think so. I think so. You know, because, you know, interestingly, one of the questions I asked, I know we're going to get into what I asked these people, but, you know, one of the questions I asked these people is what didn't matter as you look back on your lives? And, you know, the interesting thing is a very important question. What didn't matter? What did you waste your time on? And, you know, the interesting thing, Andrew, is the three things that our society tells us you must have if you're going to be happy. Number one is money, right? Things. The second is status. People say that being famous or being known or somehow having power will bring you happiness. And the third thing is pleasing other people, right? Doing what other people want you to do. And yet the interesting thing is those were the top three things that people said didn't matter as they look back on their lives. They said money beyond basic comfort never brought me happiness. Status and fame didn't matter. Pleasing other people didn't matter. It was about being true to myself. And I think, to your point, that's the countercultural message that these people brought, was that actually the things our society tells us will bring you happiness, and the whole success industry, if you will, is based on if you can get fame, get status, get money, and please other people so they think a lot of you, you'll be happy. Survey says not true. So I think, yes, very countercultural to the whole success movement in many ways, at least to a significant part of it.
Yeah, so that's a beautiful segue into talking about what the five things were. I just, when you talk about pleasing others, really, you're saying about being concerned about what other people think of you. Is that what it is?
Well, exactly. I love one of the men that I interviewed in his 80s said, you know, you spend the whole first part of your life trying to please other people, he said, and wondering what they're thinking of you. He said, and then when you're old and it's too late, you realize they weren't thinking about you at all. You know, you were just this kind of subtext in their life, and yet you focused on what they wanted you to do. And in a way, one of the most important things I heard from these people was you have to define success for yourself. That really the great task of a human life is first to define the bullseye for yourself, not your parents' bullseye, not the society's bullseye, but the thing that is most true to you. And what they said to me in so many ways again and again, and I saw it in their lives, is that those people who become clear on what the bullseye is for yourself and hit that bullseye, which may seem like failure to someone else, that's the true zone of wisdom for most of us.
Mm. So let's talk now about the secrets, the commonalities that all of them said were really the most important things that they had in their lives that made them satisfied and that you saw they all had. The first one being be true to yourself. And you've really almost segued into that. When you say being true to yourself, what does that mean?
Well, it really means a couple of things. The first thing, it means Knowing the things that bring you happiness and joy and staying close to those things. One of the things I really discovered in these interviews is, and it's not a surprise, but it was really underlined for me in a profound way, is that in a way, each one of us has a way in the world that is most true to our nature. We have a destiny, if you will. And I don't mean a destiny in like you're destined to be the prime minister or you're destined to be a doctor. What I mean is that you have a way that you're supposed to be in the world. For example, there was one man I interviewed who, when he was a very young child, the only thing that ever really he loved was nature, was being outside in nature. And he would go out all day in nature. He lived in the prairies. And then he would come home and get out his encyclopedia to figure out all the things he had seen during that day. And when he was about 8 years old, he told his mother, "When I grow up, I'm going to be a biologist." And he said he didn't even know what a biologist was, but he knew that if he was in nature, he would be happy. And so he wound up, becoming a biologist and then a conservationist. There are other people who had their parents push them to particular professions, and yet they realized early on it was not their calling. It was someone else's. And they had this moment when they surrendered, if you will, to the voice inside of them. I think of a native man who told me that when he was young, he always loved the stories of the grandmothers in his culture. And he felt he was called to be a healer, but he didn't feel worthy of that. And then later in his life, in his 30s, he finally surrendered to that voice that kept coming up for him, right? And it can not only be, this kind of, more kind of high calling. For many people, it was a very grounded just sense of hearing the one voice that was truly yours, like a man who loved photography and he had become a very successful construction manager in big condo buildings and projects. But he realized that photography was the true love of his life, and he wound up surrendering this great career as a construction manager to pursue this career in wildlife photography. And from the moment he did it, he knew it was what was most true for him. And don't get the idea that you have to throw your whole life overboard. The point is, what are the things that bring you true happiness? And here's a simple way to do it. Does the last 6 months of your life feel like you were being true to yourself? Like this is how you want to live your life. And in the book, I think I talk about the importance of reflection, of just asking that question regularly, which I found these people did. They were constantly asking, is this the life I want to be living that's true to me?
Yes, and you called it the examined life in the book. You talked about asking yourself again and again, whether your life is going in the right direction. I mean, but importantly, then making adjustments accordingly. And, getting your life more and more on track. It's like there's a constant correction, just like an airplane on a flight is not, it points towards a city and then it has to constantly course correct to stay on track.
Exactly. In fact, one of the things I worried about when I first did these interviews was I was kind of worried that, what if what I discover is that there's just one important decision you make in your entire life, right? And big crossroads moments and some people make the right ones and some people make the wrong ones, because I thought, man, that'll be depressing for people. Yeah. You're like, oh, I blew it when I was 20. I became a teacher and I should have been a businessman. But the interesting thing is I discovered, as you said, quite the opposite, that what these people had done was constantly reflect through their lives, is this feel right? Is this how I want to be living my life? Am I in the right profession? Am I with the right people? Am I doing the things that give me joy? And in a way, like great sailors, I use that analogy in the book, crossing an ocean, they may have been off course most of their lives, but they kept constantly adjusting, making small corrections, so that by the time they were 80, they said, wow, I did it. So one of the things I would say to the listeners is, make sure you build reflection into your life at least once a week. A simple discipline that I talk about in the book is just ask, did the last week of my life, the last month of my life feel like how I want to be living? And if not, what small corrections would I make? Now, over a month or 2 months, that would produce few results. Over 30 years, it would change and transform the way you lived your life.
Yes, in another section a little further on in the book, you actually talk about what you call living with intention, which is the same thing, and you give us three questions. So am I following my heart and being true to myself? Is my life focused on what really matters to me? And am I being the person I really want to be in this world? All of those, again, are course correction questions. Now, in a way, we've been talking about the bigger picture here. There's also a piece about being true to yourself, which is more moment to moment. So
yes.
in a situation, and I'm now drawing more on your experience as a minister and in mm-hmm. psychology rather than on what you wrote in the book, but there's a piece about just in every situation there's a decision that's more consistent and congruent with who we are, and so often we end up choosing the other again because what you said about, you know, maybe we want to please others, we're worried about what others think, or... So there's a moment-to-moment piece about being true to yourself as well. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, there really is. It is moment-to-moment. My grandfather, I talk about in the book, who was a shipbuilder and really one of my wise elders in my life when I was young and unfortunately died when I was 15. I wish he had lived longer. But, you know, one of the interesting things is my grandfather... used to talk about having a good tired at the end of the day as opposed to a bad tired. And just the idea that moment to moment you were making choices that were right for you. And I think that, to me, a part of it is just trusting the inner voice that's inside of us. I think so many people don't trust the inner voice. So, for example, recently I met a woman who was offered a promotion in her business, in her corporation. And she said, all the voices of others, she said, this unelected board of directors that we carry around with us, she said, the voice of my parents, the voice of my colleagues kept saying, take this promotion. You know, it's you being an important person. It's the right step for you. She said, but inside I felt like, I don't want to be even more busy. I don't want to be even more stressed. And it happens even just in little ways. Someone asks you to do something during the day and you think, well, no, I don't really want to do that. It's not going to bring me joy. But you say yes because you don't listen to the inner voice. And I think we have to trust the inner voice. It's reliable.
Well, then that's what I really mean by the moment-to-moment part. Even, I was thinking at one point, I was on a particular diet and I was not eating wheat. And I went to some mm-hmm. friend's house and they made pasta and they said, well, we're going to have pasta for lunch. Is that okay? And it was just kind of
yes.
There's a moment, there's a decision for me to make there. Am I going to stand up and be true to myself, which is that I'm at this point not eating wheat? Or am I going to just let it go and eat the wheat? Even there's not a right or wrong decision in that moment, except what's true for me.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the point. There is no right or wrong. It's knowing who you are. One of the things I talk about in the book, as someone who studied the Christian and Judeo-Christian tradition as well as the Eastern religions, and one of the interesting things is in the New Testament, the word for sin in Greek is actually a word from archery, which means to miss the mark, to just miss the bullseye. And so we often think of sin as to be bad, but actually sin is really to not know what the bullseye is or to know what it is and to choose to miss it. And so I think, as you said, moment to moment, am I making choices that, as you said, those three questions, am I being who I want to be? Am I doing the things that are true to my heart? Am I doing the things that bring me joy or following the voices of others? And I think if we do that moment to moment, we achieve this lasting happiness.
Well, and clearly, based on the people you interviewed, you do.
Exactly. And I was amazed how many of them had reflection hardwired in their life, meaning that, on any given day, they had reflection built into every day of their lives. And I thought that was quite fascinating how many of them had it hardwired.
So if be true to yourself is the first secret. The second one is now leave no regrets. Let's talk about that one.
Yeah, well, the first thing people say when they see Leave No Regrets, they say, that's not possible, right? And the answer is it is impossible, because what I meant in the second secret was not that you literally, you know, could live a life where you made no mistakes. In fact, the people I interviewed made many mistakes, but what they said to me is, when you make a mistake, forgive yourself. Don't beat yourself up. Instead, tomorrow make a different decision. And one of the things I meant, though, by leave no regrets is that I discovered in these interviews that people did not regret their failures. People didn't say, I went for love, but, you know, it didn't work out. I wrote that book, but no one would publish it. You know, I went for that. I started that business, but it failed. But almost every one of them regretted not having risked more in their lives. And what they said to me is that the greatest fear at the end of life is not to have failed, but is to have your last words be, I wish I had, or I wonder what would have happened if. And to me, Andrew, it was such a great gift for me personally. And I'll share a personal story in a moment about that. But, you know, one of the things is just to realize that we won't regret our failures, but we will regret the things we didn't try. And it caused me to realize that one of the secrets was to get off the side of the dance floor and to get out there and to do your dance. And to know that if you don't do it perfectly, or even if you fail, you won't regret that. But you will regret not doing the dance.
Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of courage required. So, really what it's about. Again, you know, being true to yourself, we know what we're being called to do. But there's this fear that comes up in terms of expressing who we are.
Indeed. And I think I learned a great deal from these people about how to overcome fear in your lives. I think of one woman who had grown up in Germany during World War II, and she was a child during the Nazi regime, and lived through the whole horror of the war and then the aftermath. And she had taken many risks in her life. One of them was coming to Canada when she was 18 years old, even though she didn't know English or French and didn't know anyone here, but she crossed the continent, crossed the sea to find a new life for herself. And I love it. One of the things she said is, whenever I had a risk to take in my life, I would imagine the worst thing that could happen in if I took that risk. And then I would ask myself, could I handle it? And she said, and then I would ask, what is the best thing that could happen if I took this risk? And she said, and then after I made the decision, I would not think about the worst thing ever again. I would always keep in front of me, what's the best thing that can happen if I do this? And let's apply that moment to moment. I meet someone at a party, and I think, I am single, and I'd like to meet that person, but I think, oh, they're too popular, too attractive, whatever it is, right? They won't be interested in me. And so I think of the worst instead of the best that could happen, and I don't take the risk. I want to publish a book, and I think, what's the worst that could happen? Every publisher in the world rejects it. But what's the best that could happen? And I think by asking ourselves, can we handle the worst, but what's the best? It's a way of programming yourself towards risk, towards healthy risk, instead of towards unhealthy fear. And I think most of us tend to focus on the worst that can happen, even though most of the time we could handle it if it happened.
Mm-hmm.
There was one woman I interviewed, for example, who was in her 70s, who had 5 unfinished books in her life. It was one of the most poignant interviews for me. And I asked her, what's with the 5 unfinished books? And I love what she said. She said, well, I guess I've always felt like if I ever finished one of them, I would have to let people read it. And maybe they'd read it and say, you don't even know how to write. Why did you ever think you could be a writer? And she said, but I guess I realize now that I would rather have a wall lined with rejection slips than to never have finished one of these books. And one of the greatest joys in my life is she just finished one of the books after our interview. She said, you know, and she just emailed me the other day, said, I'd like you to read. I finally finished one of the books. And to me, it was such a poignant story about not living in fear, but to take the chance. And maybe indeed she can't write, but so what? And I don't know. I haven't read it yet, but I'm betting she can. And it was just fear.
Yeah, and you're so like I am that and maybe so many others listening too, that what we really love is to support others to succeed. And when she does that, not only does she get the book out there and move forward, but also you get the opportunity as her coach and mentor to get some satisfaction from it too.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, one of the most wonderful things is that I got to see that in doing this book. And, of course, I see that in my own life as a speaker, as a coach to companies where, you know, there's nothing more gratifying than when, as you know, as a coach yourself, when you see someone grow. And as wise as these people were, because I learned more from them than they learned from me, there were those few people who I realized made changes in their lives because I asked them the questions.
Mm-hmm.
That about life, that they began to realize even themselves, the choices they had to make. So leave no regrets does not mean make no mistakes. What it means is get off the side of the dance floor. Take a chance. Know that failure is not the worst thing that can happen to you. I speak a lot to young people about the five secrets, and one of the things I say is, look, when you're 40 or 50 years old and you look back on high school, you won't remember the girl that rejected you or the guy who rejected you. You won't remember the fact that you tried out for the sports team and you didn't make it, or tried out for the play and you didn't get the part you wanted. But I guarantee you will think, why didn't I ask that girl out? Why didn't I try out for that team? Why didn't I try out for that play and take a chance? And even kids get it. They go, oh, I get it. You know, I'm not going to remember the mistakes, but
right.
I sure will regret not having even tried.
Well, and you know, John, a lot of our audience is in the age range 40 and 50 and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the biggest regrets that we have, and the biggest thing we hold back is, and the biggest risk we don't take is opening our hearts.
Yes.
You've had a marriage and it didn't work out or whatever, and then we get into this place, in oftentimes in my group, there's spiritualization, a superiority that becomes part of the defense strategy that's, this person isn't good enough for me or whatever, but ultimately we end up without love, and there's such a risk and such a fear that associated with opening your heart and to another person, and yet... it's also such a regret to die without having experienced that.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to sort of drum the point too hard, but I think if people really take in this fact that people did not regret their failures, the chances of the heart that they took, to me is a profound thing to know, right? Because that means if you're 40 or 50, let's say there was one woman I interviewed, for example, who was very successful in her career, just directly to your point, and she was now in her mid-60s. And I said, what are your regrets as you look back on your life? And she said, well, the only real regret I have, real regret, she said, is when I was in my 30s, I got divorced. You know, I went through a divorce with the man I'd been married to. She said, and I guess as I look back, what I regret is I never took the chance to love again. I never let anyone get close to me in that way again. And if I had my life to do over now, I would have taken the chance of being hurt again. And, you know, I think that, but even more importantly, the chance to love again. And so I think you're absolutely right, Andrew. And yet, again and again, you know, we realize when we take the chance, we're able to handle the hurts when they come, but we can't handle the regret. And most of the time, of course, when we open up our hearts again, we find that love finds us, but not until we do.
Well, the flip side of that woman also is that for many people, it would be true that maybe also her regret is that she stayed in that marriage as long as she did.
Yes, that is well.
So many of us we live in these constricted environments, whether it be a relationship or a job or something that keeps us from really fully expressing ourselves, and we regret that.
Yes, also very true. And again, one of the nice things about the five secrets is they're integrative, right? So like I actually had one reviewer, and we won't go through all the secrets right now, but he basically went through each of the secrets and he said, now if you lived each of these to the extreme, he said, like if you're so true to yourself that you walk all over other people, you know, you leave no regrets so much so that you know, you leave this whole life of just destructive risk, you know, and the point he missed was these secrets dance in a kind of delicate balance,
of
right?
Course.
Being true to yourself is the counter to, you know, to leaving no regrets, right? You know, in a way. And so they all kind of work together, if you will.
Well, I just to finish off on Leave No Regrets, because I know we've got a lot to cover in a lot of time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just had my 56th birthday, and I can tell everybody who's listening that life is starting to feel very short for me.
Yeah.
And I am now beginning to take risks and do things that, you know, I've been putting off for a long time, including restarting doing these interviews. And I really would encourage people that are in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, well, don't wait until you're 56 to start to discover that life is short.
That's right. I love one of the people I interviewed. He was a professor for many years, and I said, "What's your best advice?" One of the things I asked people was the secret to life in one sentence or less. And in the book, we have all these secrets to life in one sentence or less. And he said, "I always used to tell my students, don't count on cramming. You know, come to the end of the course and just jam it all into your head." He said, "And life is that way. Don't wait until you're old to pursue your dreams. Don't count on cramming." But the corollary to that, Andrew, and your point about, you know, this time of life in your 50s, is that a lot of people in their 40s and 50s, if you're not careful, you think it's too late to pursue my dreams, and we surrender in a kind of resignation. And I love one of my favorite interviewees, and in the book you meet all these wonderful people, was a 96-year-old painter from Toronto. And one of the things I loved about him is painting was his third career, which he began when he was almost 70 years old. And he told me a great thing. He said, "Sometimes I meet people in their 40s and 50s who are talking almost as if their life is already done. In other words, that their best things are already behind them." He said, "And I want to say to you, if you live to be my age, you may have another two adult lifetimes before you die." He said, "So don't give up on yourself." And that's what I would say to people, as you said, to young people, don't count on cramming, because we don't know how long we'll live. My father died at 36. I talk about that in the book, and I think he had a lot of unfinished business. He might have changed if he had not counted on cramming. But on the other hand, if you're 40 or 50 or 60, it's not too late to pursue a whole new life for yourself. I just met a woman the other day at one of my book talks who is 83 years old, just went back to get her PhD. If you can imagine. And I said, "Way to go, 83 years old, she's pursuing her PhD."
Fantastic. Okay. Well, I'm definitely going forward in my life, and I, you know, I've got a lot less concern about what people think about me and whether things work or don't work now that I'm 56. So everybody, get on with it. Let's keep moving, because I really want to dwell on the fifth secret. We're only just coming into the third, which is become love. So what's that mean?
Yeah, third secret, become love. In essence, become love, the Reader's Digest version of become love is first of all, make people a priority in your life. The biggest regrets that people had as they look back on their lives had to do with either not making people a priority, meaning not putting time, especially men who are listening today need to hear this. The women had far fewer regrets about love than the men did. So many men said to me, "I regret being angry with the people I loved for things that didn't matter. I regret not putting time into relationships and into friendship and into my wife and partners." So many men said, "Boy, if I had it to do over, people would have been more important to me." But the more interesting thing I discovered in these interviews is that the choice to become a loving person, and I emphasize the choice to become a loving person, is the key to happiness. So many of these people said to me when they were young, they thought the secret to life was to get love. But they said, "I realize now the secret was to be a loving person." And in a way, and I talk about in the book, they talked about three choices of love. First, the choice to love yourself and to treat yourself with respect and dignity. And again, in the book, I go into how do we do that. Second, the choice to love others who are in your life on a regular basis, family and friends, in a loving way. And finally, they said the choice to love each person you meet and to give love to them in the moment to moment, as one woman said to me, to do no harm to every person you meet in your life and to do good if you can in that moment. And I began to realize, Andrew, that these people who other people had said had found true happiness were all lovers. And I don't just mean lovers in the sense of, like, intimacy. They were lovers in the deepest sense. They were non-judgmental about others. They embraced others. They saw each opportunity, each moment-to-moment experience as an opportunity to love others deeply. And so I came to call it become love, and that the secret to happiness is to become a loving person. And again, we're not able to do it justice in a couple of minutes, but to me it is an amazing sort of things that I learned from these people about love.
Well, and I think what I liked about it is that the distinction between me being able to feel loved and experience love in the world, which is, while a crucial part of the equation, it's not something I can do on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis very easily. But to be a loving person, to open and be non-judgmental, to accept what's in front of me, to give, and so on, all of that is a choice moment to moment.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and as you know, in the book, I talk about this distinction between feeling love and choosing love, right? And it begins with ourself. I might not feel loving towards myself because of how I was raised or, you know, all kinds of reasons why people don't feel loving towards themselves. But I can choose to treat myself with love, to not indulge thoughts that diminish my worthiness. I can choose to be kind and loving to others, even if I can't ensure that they will be kind and loving to me. And once we realize that love is a choice, not merely a feeling, it's transformative, I think, in a way for us.
Well, and you know, we're back to the same thing. Every one of these so far has really required an awareness. To be true to yourself requires me to be tuned into and living with, asking myself the question, you know, is this for me or not? The same with living with no regrets, asking yourself the question moment to moment. You know, now we're talking about being loving. It's the same thing. It's a moment-to-moment decision.
Here's a simple example. One of the people I interviewed talked about the importance of loving yourself, and he said to me, you can't love others if you can't embrace yourself. And one of the things that he said was, you know, each moment to moment in those thoughts we have all day long about ourselves, he said, we either plant weeds or flowers in our subconscious. It was such a great image for me. And he said, you know, whenever you find yourself planting a weed in your subconscious, I'm not attractive, I'm not as smart, you compare yourself with others, you know, you beat yourself up in some way about regrets, he said, pluck the weed out and plant a flower instead. And he said, it's a moment-to-moment thing where you're training your mind, right? And I think so many of us, we think that our minds are in control of us, but one of the things I've discovered is actually we have the power to control our thoughts, to not maybe the first thought, the instinctual one, but to choose to pluck the weed out and plant a flower instead, moment-to-moment in our lives. So someone listening today might ask, what are the weeds I'm planting right now in my subconscious about myself, about other people, about the world? And what flowers could I replace in that garden in my subconscious, which, of course, ultimately every thought is a prayer we send to the subconscious. If I say I'm not as good as others, I send a prayer to the subconscious to act in an unworthy way. If I say other people are not trustworthy, I plant a prayer in my subconscious to see the untrustworthiness of others.
And it's not just if I say it, but if I think it.
Exactly. And the first, you know, Billy Graham had a great line about lust once. I love this line. He said, the first look is instinct. He said, but the second look is a choice. And I often feel the same thing is true of our thoughts. We're all going to have negative or unworthy or unproductive thoughts about ourselves, about others, about the world, about our fears. The first thought may be instinct, but the second one, indulging it, is a choice. And it's kind of a good way to think about it.
That's very, very nice. And it actually is a beautiful segue, and thank you very much, over to the fourth secret, which is really live in the moment.
Yes, yes. And, you know, one of the things people often ask me is, you know, were the five secrets like blazingly obvious? You know, because obviously when you have 18,000 years of life experience, 250 interviews, and some of them were just like right there right away. Be true to yourself. We got it. You know, become love. We got it. This was one that was kind of, in a way, we had to make some choices because live the moment really came to represent a whole set of things that people said to us. They said, first of all, life is short, so live each moment fully. Don't count on tomorrow. They said, don't live in regret because you can't change the past. It's a waste of your life space. But neither worry about things in the future that you can't change. All you can do is be in the moment, moment to moment. And they also said, be in the moment with gratitude. They said, don't believe that happiness is in anything you don't have right now. No achievement, no person, no future thing. But that happiness is a choice we are able to make moment to moment by being in a place of gratitude. And so live the moment came for me to represent almost a style of living that these people were saying, which is wherever you are, really be there. Stop thinking happiness is outside yourself. Choose happiness instead. Don't beat yourself up about regret or burden yourself with worry about the future, but keep pulling yourself back into the moment you're in, where you have power. And so this was, in a way, the most elusive secret because it combined a whole set of things that I came to feel really they were saying, live in the moment, be in the moment fully, and not live for the moment, very different, but live in the moment. A subtle but important distinction.
Right, so again, back to the choice of our thoughts. I mean, you talk in the book about how when we're being judgmental and critical of ourselves, we're in you know, even if I'm having that thought in the moment, it's based on the past.
Exactly, exactly. You know, you're absolutely right. And I think that, you know, this training your mind again. One of the things I talk about in the Five Secrets You Must Discover is this idea of training your mind for happiness. I began to realize that these people had done something that most of us never do, which is over years they had trained their minds for happiness by building reflection in, by focusing on gratitude, by choosing to plant flowers instead of weeds in the subconscious, by the things they indulged, by choosing moment to moment to love even when they didn't feel like loving. And what I realized is that they were training their souls and minds for happiness. And so I think many of us actually live as if we're out of control of training ourselves. And this is very destructive, of course, because in a way then we're merely at the whim of the moment to moment of what's happening instead of realizing that our mind, our soul, is like a muscle. If you train it, it begins to respond. And once we train it, it becomes robust and vital and leads to this kind of joy that is, if you will, you can't lose.
And the training here is to consciously and constantly be bringing ourselves back to live the moment.
Exactly. And I talk in the book about ways to train ourselves to be in the moment. And you know, one of them is just to, whenever you're not in the moment, to stop yourself. Just to stop and to gently pull yourself, don't beat yourself up, just gently pull yourself back into the moment. And I talk in the book about when I learned to meditate, which has been an important part of my life, is that when you first start to meditate, you have all these other thoughts that come in that you have to fight. And my meditation teacher told me, don't fight the thoughts. Just gently brush them aside and say, not now, and come back into the moment of meditation. And I talk in the book about how you can train yourself to be in the moment partly by just gently stopping yourself whenever you're not, and gently brushing it aside. And in the beginning, you may have to do that all the time. But over time, your mind, your soul, gets trained to be in the moment. And then you don't have to do it anymore. But see, many of us don't do that. We just give up. And so be patient with yourself. But train yourself. Don't you have to, it's, again, it's like going to the gym. The soul is like your muscles. Unless you train it, it will lead you sometimes in directions you don't want.
And it, you know, it's really a lot about habit, which is, again, a nice segue to the fifth and final secret, which is it's habit, much, much more than habit as well. But the fifth and final secret, give more than you take. Talk
yes,
to us about that.
Yes. Well, you know, when I asked people, Andrew, what was the thing that gave their life the greatest meaning as they looked back, one of the most interesting things to me is that is that people said when I was young, I thought the things that would bring me the greatest happiness in the world would be what I took from the world. But now that I'm old, I realize the greatest meaning in my life is not what I took, but what I gave. And it was different for each person. For some, it was a cause, something that biologists, he could look at the map and know there were areas that would be saved in nature because he was here. For other people, it was their children and knowing they were better human beings than they were. For some people, it was just knowing moment to moment in their lives they had been kind and generous and had added value to the world. And I love one 70-year-old woman who had actually been an assistant to Cesar Chavez, the great farm organizer in California, said that, you know, until you learn to cry for the world instead of yourself, you'll never be happy. Another woman said to me, happiness cannot be pursued. It's a byproduct of being of service in your life. And I think that's the lesson I learned from these people. One native chief told me, the younger you are when you realize that it's what you give, not what you take, that will bring you happiness, the more happiness you will find. So I realized happy people were givers in the truest way. When they woke up in the morning, they asked the question, what can I give the world, instead of what it will give me? And one of the points I always make to people is we have 100% control over what we give every day, and almost no control ultimately of what we get. So the happiest people focus on what they can give. And, of course, all the spiritual traditions have told us this. And in the end, and I talk about this in the book, I realize perhaps the two great acts of life are first to find yourself, to know who you are and what brings you happiness, and to focus on those things. And the second great act of life was to give yourself away, to realize that you, in a way, were unimportant unless you somehow contributed to the greater good. And these people talked to me about that in a way. They said, find yourself, but also lose yourself.
Uh-huh. So the happiest people are the ones that are least focused on themselves.
That's ironically, right? And again, this is where the secrets must go together, right? Because someone said to me, but I know people who give, and they resent it. Well, that's because they're probably not also being true to themselves, right?
And right.
So this is why we don't just give. We also have to know who we are and the things that bring us happiness, but we can't just focus on ourselves. We also have to, as I said earlier, feel like something was different because we were here. So this is in the way how the secrets dance together in these people's lives. You know, there's a great Tolstoy quote about families where he says, in Anna Karenina, he says that all unhappy families are unhappy in their own way. He said, but all happy families are happy in the same way. And in some ways, what I discovered in these interviews, it's a great kind of capstone for our conversation in some ways, is that all unhappy people are probably unhappy in their own unique way. But all happy people somehow do these five things. They know who they are and focus moment to moment on what matters to them. They leave no regrets and take chances and risks of going towards their dreams and opening up their hearts. They love deeply and have an intention to love. They live in the moment, moment to moment, not judging their life, but living it and being in gratitude. And finally, they give and they ask, how can I make the world better? And they find some cause, whatever it is, that they attach to in their lives and give themselves away. And to me, that was the greatest gift. I realized there weren't 20 or 30 or 50 secrets, but that if you examine these people's lives, it became so clear that these five things had guided their journey.
Well, and you talk more in the book about you know, confronting death and religion and how it all fits in and the role of rituals and so on. But I think my last question I want to ask you is related to how did interviewing these people affect you? What changes did you make in your life, if you don't mind me asking?
No, it's a great question. And just one point about what you just said. You know, a lot of people say, oh, well, that's good. I got the secrets now. I got it. Well, I think, as you said, there's so much in the book about, first of all, hearing the stories of these people's lives, and then the things that I talk about in terms of how do we live these secrets. And so I feel in some ways we've just scratched the surface, if people can believe that. So, you know, a great reason to either get the book for yourself, and also a great gift for a young person or someone who's, you know, in a journey in their own lives.
Well, and just so people know, I've already given away about 100 of them, so there's 100 people that actually don't need to purchase one.
There you go. But yeah, it's a great gift for others, a great gift for yourself. But what did I learn? Two things. One is I feel now like I have these wise grandmothers and grandfathers that I carry around with me. Whenever I'm not being in the moment, I think of the 96-year-old painter talking about how he cries whenever he sees a sunset or a ballet now because he doesn't know how many more he will see. And he says, "Wherever, whatever age you are, you have to live your life that way." And I pull myself back into the moment. Whenever I find myself comparing myself with others, which we're all prone to do. I think of a 100-year-old woman who told me that comparison was the thief of joy and that you had to recognize that other people had different gifts than you. So stop comparing yourself with them. So the reason I'm giving these examples is what I found is rather than one big change in my life, Andrew, a more wonderful thing has happened, which is moment to moment, I find myself being moved towards these small decisions. When I find myself focusing on things, for example, I realize, wow, I haven't spent any time with my friends this week. I haven't really been with my kids this week. Leave these things at your desk and go love, because that's what you'll regret at the end of your life. So I think when people read the book, what they'll find is, like me, they'll find their favorite wise elders, the Jiminy Crickets who will sit on their shoulders. And that's what's happened for me, is I got these people now, in a way, they sit with me, and they whisper in my ear moment to moment. And that's what I hope would happen for the reader as well, because that's what's happened for me. And even if no one ever read the book, I got such a gift out of it because these people are now in my life. And some of them have become friends as well, but they're here moment to moment, reminding me. And that's what most of us need, reminders, moment to moment.
So the book is called The Five Secrets You Must Discover Before You Die. It's Dr. John Izzo, and that's I-Z-Z-O if you're in Canada, or I-Z-Z-O if you're in the United States. And drjohnizzo.com is the website. Now, if you're looking for a book, probably just as easy to go to Amazon and order it, or Chapters in Canada.
Exactly. Chapters, Amazon, et cetera, for The Five Secrets You Must Discover Before You Die. Now, if people are more visual, if they go to my site, Dr. John, drjohnizzo.com, so drjohnizzo.com, what they'll find is also the TV series, if they go to store, the five-hour TV series we did for Biography and PBS, which is actually me speaking before a live audience, five one-hour segments on the secrets, and also clips from the interviews from about 12 of the people that we interviewed along each secret. So if you're more visual and the kind of, or you want to share it as a family or among friends, the DVD series is a great choice.
Well, and for $49, I mean, it just seems incredible. So the place to buy that is on your website, and I'm definitely going to go in and order one. For everybody who's listening, I love this book. This is a life-changing book. And one of the best things I didn't mention is that at the end of the book, he actually includes all of the questions that they asked when they were doing the interview. So I actually used this to interview my dad and a few other people that I consider to be wise elders. So that's been fantastic, too.
Well, yeah, one of the things that we hoped, and one of my colleagues, Olivia McIver, who I know you know as well, who helped me do the interviews, that was Olivia's idea, actually, to give her credit. She said, let's put in the book the questions we asked people and encourage people to interview their own wise elders. And I've actually had people email me and call me and say, I used those questions to interview my dad or my grandfather, and they died. And now I've got this tape recording of their wisdom that I can share and listen to again and again and share with others in our family. So yeah, I'm so proud of this work. You know, books are kind of like children, I say. You shouldn't have one that you like more than another. But I think of all the things I've written, the five books, including Second Innocence and this book, I just feel so proud of this work and such a deep responsibility of having shared the wisdom of these people. At least seven of the 250 have died since we did the interviews. So I feel like I continue to channel their wisdom as well.
That's wonderful. And by the way, for the listener, the book, The Five Secrets, it's really a spin-off. It's a second a secondary step beyond John's book, Second Innocence, which is also philosophical in nature and would be very consistent. If you like this book, then you definitely, Second Innocence would be a read for you.
Yeah, one way to think about it, Second Innocence, which is a book about keeping a sense of joy and wonder and not becoming cynical, if you will, in our lives, is the story of my life. It's really where I share all these people I had met over the years and my experiences as a minister and then in my own life and journey as a parent, in marriage, etc. And then this book is what I learned from these other people. But people who've read both say they're a great pair, Second Innocence and The Five Secrets, because in a way one is a more personal journey from me, the other an outward journey of listening to the lives of these people.
John, I really appreciate you doing this interview because I know that your target audience isn't so much the smaller entrepreneurs that we have in ProCoach, but it's more, you know, really your primary focus is speaking to corporations, to speaking at conferences. I mean, you've already spoken to over a million people. And you talk about leadership issues. You also talk about inspiring people in their personal lives. So if anybody was to want to have you speak at their conference or they know an organization that could benefit from having you speak, they just contact you through the website?
Exactly. And again, each year I speak to about 70 audiences all over the world, associations, conferences, corporate events, both on personal growth and also on creating a passionate workplace, which have been the two great passions of my life. So again, they can just go to our website, drjohnizzo.com, and they'll see all they need.
Well, fantastic. Listen, we need to wrap up now, but on behalf of myself and our ProCoach audience, I just want to thank you so much for taking this time. It's really wonderful.
Thank you, Andrew, and I wish a great blessing to your listeners. And remember, those who live these secrets will not be afraid to die. This isn't a book about death. It's a book about life.
Fantastic. So that's it for
this
month, listeners. This is Andrew Barber-Starkey saying goodbye for now, and I look forward to bringing you another Mastermind interview presentation next month.